This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up. The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
This is ContactTalkRadio.com, consciousness in action, and you are taking action into your consciousness by tuning into Contact Talk Radio.
And on TuneIn.com, Ping.fm, and UpSnap Mobile.
Contact Talk Radio.
Welcome to Living Fearlessly with your host, Lisa McDonald.
My mama told me when I...
Good morning, everybody. Thank you so very much for rejoining me again on this lovely Friday morning. My name is Lisa McDonald, host of Living Fearlessly with the Contact Talk Radio Network. Listenership spans 145 countries, 220 TV radio terrestrial satellites, and the potential for millions of iTunes downloads. Before introducing my phenomenal guest of this week, I just want to first, as I always do, thank my corporate sponsors, which include AHA That, Forever, and Halton Honda. I also want to thank the loyal listeners and the podcast subscribers, as well as the people who take the time to review the show and also send in lovely testimonials and endorsements supporting what it is that you feel you got out of the content of my guest and interview of each week. I also want to remind people and thank my partners and family members as well over at C-Suite Radio Network, where, of course, following the live show, you can eventually find the podcast link also on my host page, Living Fearlessly with Lisa McDonald. So who is my guest today? Well, my guest is a phenomenal journalist by the name of Carmen Gentile. Absolutely love the last name. So Carmen Gentile is the author of the critically acclaimed book, Blindsided by the Taliban, the story of his injury while reporting on the war in Afghanistan. His work has appeared in Esquire, The New York Times, USA Today, and many other leading publications. In addition to war reporting, Carmen also writes about motorcycling in unusual places like Iraq. Good morning, Carmen. How are you?
Wonderful. How are you?
I'm doing amazing. It's lovely to have you here. We've been talking about bringing you onto the show and pre-scheduling this for quite some time, and now the day is finally upon us. So I couldn't be more grateful for the gift of your time because I know how incredibly off the hook you are. So I'm just going to dive right in, Carmen. So, you know, there's so many layers within your story that really appeals to me, as it would to the listening audience. But first, I want to say, I'm grateful that you're here. I'm grateful that you survived that injury. It was a pretty major one, life-altering and transformational, which we'll delve into, and you can share the complexities of all of that with the listening audience. But I'm just so grateful that you're here, that you're alive, you're thriving, you've got a wonderful family, and the legacy continues. So good on you.
Appreciate that. Glad to be here and glad to have survived and glad that I can
absolutely
share my story.
Well, you know, one thing I want to first start off by saying, because, I mean, this is organic in nature. It's unscripted dialogue for people who closely follow me. I think it makes for a much more authentic discussion. But I'm always interested in the inception of my guest's journey. Now, you as a journalist, we know that basically the job, you're here to deliver the facts. You're here to remain objective and impartial and as neutral as what you possibly can be in the way of your reporting. That's the job. So fast forward to where we are today, that many years later, after that incident and your time specifically related to that incident having already transpired. You know, would you be able to freely share with myself and the listeners and the podcast subscribers, Carmen, any feelings, personal feelings, either politically, spiritually, that you could interject into offering some insights and some revelations for what that was now that you've had an opportunity to process and decompress from that?
Well, it's hard for me to separate my personal experience with my work now in Afghanistan. The two have become so intertwined, not just because of my book, but because of what had happened to me. I feel as though I have to be even more cognizant of the fact that I need to be objective because it, for example, if I'm doing a story while accompanying U.S. forces in an embed, and it was it was soldiers and men and women and who saved my life, both on the front lines and in the rear in when they operated on me in Afghanistan. So I have a personal special feeling in my heart for them. But I also know that when I'm doing my job, that I have to be still be objective and still portray the facts as they are. Mm-hmm. So it adds an additional layer of complication to my objectivity. But I'm cognizant of it, so it's something that I just have to continually remind myself when I'm doing the job.
Okay, fair enough. And do you feel, looking back on that, was it a justified war? Did it make sense for you to be there? I know you kind of have to just go and take the order for where it is you need to go. But was there any inner conflict that was going on for you at the time in terms of, really things did not have to escalate to this point, or maybe this isn't warranted, maybe it isn't justified, or maybe there's another perspective that the rest of the world outside of those on the inside, such as us reporters and correspondents, aren't necessarily privy to that would make it a little bit more convoluted?
Well, the fact of the matter is, I was there because I wanted to be there.
Okay.
And nobody forced my hand to be in Afghanistan. It was something that I wanted to do. It was the career path that I have chosen. It's those are the types of stories that I wanted to cover. So mm-hmm. my being there was of my own volition. And so I would never say that I had no choice. But I am asked this all the time. And I like to kid that every time someone asks me why I do it or why I would go and put myself in that position, I give a different answer. So mm-hmm. let me – the original answer that I'm giving you on your show is the fact is that I have an inner drive that wants to see things as they are, no matter how terrible the situation may be that are unvarnished by anyone else's perception. Am I making any sense? I want to be there yep. on first. I want to see it with my own eyes. I'm the type of reporter that has to have the thing happen in front of me in order to tell the story. I'm not a deep dive, rifling through the filing cabinet with the flashlight between my teeth reporter. I'm not that guy, I don't have secret meetings in parking garages at 3 a.m. I go to places where things are happening in broad daylight and the events are unfolding in front of me. And I think it's basically an extension of all the work that I'd ever done when I first started out working in a local newspaper while still in college. And I'm still that same guy. I talk to people, notebook in hand, and say, tell me your story. What's happening here? And that's the kind of reporter I am. And that means I have to be right on the ground where things are happening. And that's
amazing. I'm just going to scale back a little bit and delve a little bit deeper into something you said, which I think is quite pivotal. This is why you're on my show, Carmen. This is why you're truly embodying the spirit of what it means to live fearlessly, because for you to have indicated, it's not enough for me to go rifling through the filing cabinet, for me to really dig my teeth in and to really get a sense of what is truly going on, I have to be on the front lines. And I think whether you're talking about journalism, I think, you probably, that's not something that's compartmentalized or specific to journalism, and news reporting, itself. It probably speaks to every aspect of your life. You're in it. You're in the trenches. You're up close and personal. You're not cowering behind anybody. You're not just taking somebody else's word for it or somebody else's opinion. You're actually figuring this out yourself, as you indicated, with your own eyes. So I just want to commend you on that, because a lot of people, specifically when we're talking about what it means to live fearlessly, people just aren't willing to make that leap of faith.
Yeah, it's part of me feels as though I have a compulsion that I can't say no to. I just got done saying that no one makes me do anything. Well, there's that one side of me that does make me do it. And maybe there's that argument between that side and the other side that says, wow, you shouldn't be doing this. And it's that constant conversation that makes myself sound like I'm schizophrenic, but really what we all have these inner monologues and internal debates, right? Should I do this? Mm-hmm. Should I not do this? This is how I, if I go this way, this is the way my career is going to go or my life's going to go, blah, blah, blah. I find I'm better at making the decisions that are, this is going to sound terrible. I feel like I'm better at making life or death decisions than I am making regular everyday decisions.
Get it. I totally get it.
Yeah.
I get that. You're speaking to me 100%. Absolutely. I get that. So let's talk about the life-death moment. Let's go back to that absolute precise moment to the degree that you can remember it. I don't know if it's a slow-mo that plays over in your head. I don't know if you were completely oblivious to it because it just happens so quickly. What do you remember from that moment where you were shot?
Well, I remember it very vividly because I never lost consciousness. I was embedded with U.S. forces along the Afghan-Pakistani border, just a couple miles from the border with Pakistan, and it was a very remote mountainous village. When I say village, it was just a couple of stone huts along a very narrow dirt road. And along with a platoon of soldiers, I was walking through this village, and I already had a really, really hinky vibe about what was going on. Typically, when you go into an area and the children are nice to you and they want to give the soldiers high fives and, you know, smile at you, things are okay. But in this occasion, there were no kids around. And any soldier or Marine will tell you when the kids scatter, something's going to happen. Hmm. So there were no kids around, and we were talking to these people in the village. There were a couple of young men on the side of the road, just sitting on the side of this little dirt road. And I had my video camera trained on them, and I was asking them questions, and I was so certain that something was wrong that I was stammering out questions, and I couldn't even understand what they were telling me back through the interpreter. And then all of a sudden I hear this whooshing sound from behind me, and I turn around, and about 40 yards down the road, there's a man shouldering a rocket propelled grenade launcher. Now for your listeners, I don't know if they know what that is, but it's that long cylindrical tube that has that shoots the projectile with a conical tip on it. And that conical projectile is a grenade. It's an explosive device. So he fired that right at the group of us, and it came on a beeline right toward me, and it actually hit me in the side of the face and didn't detonate, but the ordnance hit me in the side of the face. And it immediately, my right eye went black, and I went blind in my right eye, and all the bones in the side of my face just shattered into a thousand shards. And then the thing bounced off of me, hit the platoon leader in the elbow, and then clattered to the ground. And I dropped my video camera, but the camera keeps running, and you can hear in the video, someone asked me if I'm okay, and I said, no, obviously, no, I'm not okay. I just got the face with an RPG that didn't go out. Actually, the thing hit me in the face, and I, my eye went black. I thought, well, okay, I'm dead. Because the lights went out, and I figured, okay, this is what happens when the lights go out. You know, maybe you're dead, but you're still, you know, there's some consciousness, but I'm going to be done soon. But I hit the ground, took one knee, and all of a sudden I just felt this blood pouring out of my face and was all over this dirt road. And I realized that I had in fact not been killed, but that's when the real mayhem kicked off.
Wow. And so as a result of, you know, you connecting the dots in those exact moments and you realized, okay, I'm not dead, but I realized that I've been seriously injured. Your right eye goes black. What are you feeling? Like, do you even recollect what it was you were feeling outside of being detail, factual oriented and going, okay, this is just what's transpired? What did you have? Were you thinking about anybody when people talk about those moments having occurred? You know, other certain type thoughts come to you. You're either thinking about your family or you're thinking about regrets or you're thinking about a whole host of things. You know, do you remember having any specific thoughts?
Here's how it went down for me. I had fractions of a second between the time I saw the ordnance coming toward me and the time of impact. I mean, just maybe a maybe a second and a half. And in that second and a half, my legs felt glued to the ground as I watched this thing screaming toward me. And I went from full onslaught of panic to resignation that I was going to die in a nanosecond. It just
wow.
was a burst of adrenaline and fear. And then it came over me quickly that, well, this is it. I'm done. And it's going to be over soon.
And so you never had the luxury of blacking out? Jeez.
I was never so fortunate. And I was awake throughout the whole treatment on the scene, and then emergency evacuation. They have there's a division of the Air Force called the Pararescue Jumpers. They're highly trained rescue medics that fly into very dangerous situations. They came to get me. They landed the helicopter, pulled me out, and then I was eventually flown to the U.S. military hospital at Bagram. One of the largest military bases in northern Afghanistan, and they took me there, and I had the first of many surgeries. There was an Air Force ophthalmologist on duty who was able to partially repair my eye. The actual globe of my eye had been lacerated, not to get too yucky for your listeners, but there's a jelly inside your eye that gives it its nice global firm shape, and all that jelly had spilled out into my skull cavity. And they had to scoop up that jelly and put it back in my eye and sew that up. And I woke up in the hospital at the U.S. military hospital several hours later. I don't know. This is all detailed in my book. But and then they initially told me amidst all in my narcotic haze that I was probably going to lose the eye. Because I was so doped up, I thought, it's fine. I'll just wear an eye patch. It'll look cool. And, you know, it's all fine here. I can't even feel my toes. I'm on so many opioids right now. This is all fine. I'll get it. Right? So.
Wow.
So, yeah, that was how I handled it initially. And, but that was only the beginning. There's months of recovery and.
No doubt.
Personal and physical shenanigans that ensued until I was able to get back up on my feet and back up on the horse of in-bed reporting.
And so in terms of the healing recovery process, what was the most staggered part of that for you? Was it emotionally? Was it mentally? Was it physically? Was it spiritually? What part was the last part for you to get recalibrated with the mindset of, okay, ready, set, go again?
I would say, the emotional, part, that was the very difficult period in my life because I was having, I don't want to spoil too much of the story because I want people to read the book. I was having a romantic interlude problem, with a woman with whom I had been involved and was seriously involved at that time. And, things subsequently fell apart, and were adversely affected by my injury. And then, I spiraled downward from there. And I think, well, I know that I used my injury to excuse a lot of my later, abhorrent behavior because I thought, well, hey, I got shot in the face with an RPG. I can do whatever I damn well please now. Mm-hmm. And so for months on end after my injury, as I was recovering, I was cashing in on everyone's sympathy and not always being as considerate as I could have been, to the point where about 4 months after I'd been hurt, there were a whole bunch of people that were done dealing with me. They figured this guy's an exceptional pain in the ass. We're not hang out with him anymore.
Right.
So all that goodwill I had earned from getting shot in the face was used up by the time Christmas rolled around.
Oh, geez.
I spent a good deal of time by myself trying to figure out how to make myself whole again. And then I came to the conclusion that the only real way I was going to get whole was if I went back to Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
Better
now, Now, going back to what you just said, and I commend you on saying that, a lot of people don't own their stuff. A lot of people don't see the cause and effect of, you know, action, reaction, behaviorally. Have you had the opportunity, or have people granted you the opportunity to either apologize or to atone or to get some kind of closure with some of these things?
Some of them I have apologized to in the book. In fact, I said in the acknowledgments, if I were to apologize to everyone individually in these pages, it would be longer than the rest of the prose. But I wrote the book as a way of apologizing for some of my less than admirable behavior along the way. And I hope that some of those that were on the receiving end of it have had the opportunity to read it.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Good job.
Yeah.
Good job. Now, yeah, the word's still out, eh? Verdict's still out on that. No, but you did the right thing. You did the right thing. So, I mean, as long as you took the measures to do what you knew was right, doesn't matter how many months or years after the fact, you know, people choose to come around and understand and believe the sincerity of what it is you've had to say, and then putting into perspective, well, how would I have been if I'd gone through that set of unique circumstances? How could I really say for sure that I would be positive, chipper? You know, these things happen, but, you know, you atoned for it. So good for you. Now, just generically talking about news as a subject matter, you know, there are some people who perhaps would be of the philosophy or the belief that news of today perpetuates fear, greed, consumption, and would serve to subconsciously, you know, immobilize people and submerge people into the abyss of fear. What do you say about the culture of news reporting of these days, of our times?
Well, you know, we went from a period just a few years ago where everyone was saying that mainstream news is on the decline, and there's even leading organizations like the New York Times and the Washington Post, et cetera, are experiencing lean years, et cetera, et cetera. No one's reading. That I think all of that is just not the case.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen in the last few years, people are actually taking a more concerted effort to pay attention to what's going on, particularly in U.S. politics now. So organizations like the New York Times, like the Washington Post, have seen their subscriptions go through the roof in the last couple of years. Readership has expanded greatly. People are actually paying attention. And the fact of the matter is there is a market even among millennials for good deep dive long form journalism. And even in print for that matter. And I mean print in publications, handheld publications, because the younger readers aren't as addicted to their devices as the Gen X types like myself, who remember what it was like, you know, pre-internet, but we were greatly seduced by our devices and have become glued to our phones in ways that the younger folks are not. So I think that there's a lot of great journalism out there. I think that there's a lot of really good reporting. You know, it's funny. I have people ask me, quite often about, you know, where should I get my news? What should I watch? And I think to myself, why are you asking me what to watch? Why don't you read? Don't complain to me that, well, CNN is biased and Fox News is biased and what, but then don't watch it. It's, for the most part, they're regurgitating the same handful of stories every day on and on and on. Whereas you can go to the wealth of knowledge that you carry around in your pocket and look at any number of stories, or even if you want to go old school and pick up a paper or a magazine, there's great stuff out there that is informative, that will teach you more about different perspectives on the world, that will provide you more varied perspectives on the world than you'll ever get listening to the same 12 pundits on CNN and 12 on Fox, you know, toe their same lines. Just don't listen to that. That's ridiculous.
Exactly. Well, I want to circle back to something you said, because, you know, yes, there might be an increase, a radical increase in terms of number of subscribers and viewership and readership and listenership and everything be on the up and up. That doesn't necessarily, as you and I would both know, that doesn't equate to the caliber or the quality, not necessarily the quality of the news, but in terms of, you know, going back to my original point, you know, does news, because predominantly we know that the news that's being reported, especially in the culture of what's happening either on the political realm or what's happening with climate change, you know, succession of hurricanes, we're in the midst of a couple right now, you know, so numbers go up because, you know, unfortunately there's still some truth to the fact that people are more choose to be more gravitating towards negativity, either because they haven't chosen to do the internal work on themselves where they would err more on the side of positivity and keeping things vibrant in their own mindset. I'm not dissing the news here. I'm just talking about what we know to be in terms of alternative opinions around the news, in terms of fear mongering, in terms of, you know, everything in the world is going to shit, you know, all this stuff. Like, you know, people feed off of that because it makes what, by comparison, what's going on in their individual lives fare better for them in the perception of that and in the handling of that. So what do you say about that?
Well, 20 years ago, we had, and I mean the collective English-speaking North American media had what I would say is a relatively fairly agreed upon set of facts mm-hmm. when it came to a particular news story or a particular event. We were different ways in which to look at a story through various publications, whether it was a left-leaning publication like the New York Times or a right-leaning publication like the Wall Street Journal. But everything else, you know, we had a fairly agreed upon set of facts about what, for example, happened on a particular day at a particular time. We don't have that anymore. In the 21st century of multiple media outlets and where everyone who's a quote unquote citizen journalist can blog or put something up on Facebook that people will then gravitate to because it best represents how they feel about a certain subject, whether or not it's true or not, is it where we find ourselves. Well, that's why we're more, even though we have greater connectivity, we're more splintered in our perception of reality than at any time, obviously, in my lifetime. And I would have to dig deeper into seeing when was the last time it's in U.S. history that I've, you know, being American, why I would, I, you know, I can't imagine that it was ever been like this, in modern times. Let's look at just something that is being debated, though I can't understand why right now. Donald Trump recently said that 3,000 people in
Puerto
Rico didn't die in the hurricane when there have been numerous long-form, month-long studies that were ratified and accepted by the U.S. government that was, in fact, the case, that 2,975 people died as a result of Hurricane Maria. He can't accept it, so he says it otherwise, and legions of people will believe what he says.
And that's a good point, because spin sells, right? Questionable truth sells. Why, you know, for somebody who's at that level of governance, for somebody who has that type of control, that type of power, I mean, we could talk, I mean, that's Donald Trump. That's a week of shows in itself for me. You know, but what do you think's going on there? Like mental health for sure, right?
Him?
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's just digress for a minute,
okay? And this will sum it up succinctly, and this will let you know where I stand. He's an abhorrent jackass, and
yes.
He only cares about himself. That's
yes.
it. That's nothing else to it. Is he mentally incompetent? I don't know. Maybe. It doesn't even matter whether or not he's – because by saying he's mentally incompetent – you're somewhat subtly excusing the behavior.
True.
I think he was probably like this his entire life. He hasn't evolved since he was 6 years old. This is and there are legions of people who are okay with it, either because they're getting the tax cuts they want, the deregulations that they want, or the fact that he sticks his thumb in the eye of all the people that they hate, which is the establishment.
Right.
And okay with it. And for whatever other myriad reasons why 63 million Americans voted for it, I don't know. But that's it. That's all there is to it. His ego can't handle the fact that he thinks that people think that under his watch, the U.S. government did a bad job in Puerto Rico.
Right. Yeah. So for somebody of your caliber, for somebody who does precisely what it is you do for a living in terms of journalism, being very cognizant of analytics, trends, previous outcomes that are somewhat on similar trajectories of where they're going and where things are going to land, what do you forecast for this current government? Like, and what's the domino effect? What do you foresee happening either in the short term or the long term as a result of him still being at the helm?
Well, I have, during the course of my career, covered these types of hardline governments in the Middle East, in Africa, in Latin America. I have seen the ill effects of a manipulative leader who has a cult-like following and does everything he can to discredit the mainstream independent press. In that event, things get worse before they get better. And often in those places that I mentioned, things never get better. Mm-hmm. We have in the United States, a robust, founding document in the Constitution that has stood up to other leaders who didn't, uphold their oath to defend the Constitution, but and tried to manipulate it to their own design. But this is at a whole new level. The founders never, I believe, had in mind that somebody this cripplingly deceptive and self-serving could ever ascend to the presidency. And now that it's happened, I think that we're in a position whereby things could get a lot worse. I know for a fact that in there are those who in America will there are enough, we have enough crazies running around in America that have a dozen or more arms in their closet that I worry about. And if it's only a fraction of his supporters, were he to be impeached or removed from office, I think we could be looking at a potentially violent upheaval in the United States. I truly do.
So you think that you think the state of current affairs can plummet any further with him currently being at the helm? Like, I don't even know.
We're near the bottom. I mean, every time they proclaim a new low for something that he's said or done, he gets the shovel out and says, let's see how deeper we can go.
I can outdo myself.
Remember when disgraced the name of the late great John McCain in 2015?
Yes.
And people had been captured. We all thought, oh, that's it. His candidacy is over. There's no way you could say something like that. Out comes the shovel. Just dig deeper. Gets caught on tape bragging about assaulting women. Let's get the shovel and we'll keep digging deeper. Deeper and deeper we go. This is the strategy of an authoritarian dictatorship. This is what they do. They keep piling on greater and greater offenses so that you can't keep up with them. And also the bar for what's offensive keeps getting pushed further and further. So if he says something a little less offensive or actually gives a State of the Union speech where he doesn't babble like an idiot because he's read from a teleprompter, people think, well, wow, he's acting presidential.
Right.
You know, that's because Americans have a really difficult time maintaining and remembering our sense of history.
Mm-hmm.
It's difficult for them to, because if Americans had a deep dive understanding of history, the parallels between this situation and Watergate alone would make his continuing presidency just inconceivable.
But absolutely, but
because people don't study history and aren't taught history adequately, civics. That's another problem in the United States. Somebody like him could come to power because he promises to, quote unquote, run the country like a business. I don't know. I don't spend a lot of time in offices, but I have had a job where I've had to sit in an office. That's not a democracy. You walk into an office building and your boss is the dictator. He tells you what to do. You suspend rights when you walk into the room and then walk into an office. And then when you leave at the end of the day, you resume being free. But that's not a business, and a government are not congruent. Those aren't two. One is an autocracy, and one is hopefully closer to a democracy.
Right. Now let's quickly switch to, because there's still other things in ground that I want to cover with you. So who do you think the anonymous author is?
I've gone back and forth on this many a time, and I get to play amateur sleuth too. Like I said, I don't do this kind of journalism, but yeah, I catch myself trying to figure it out as well. Oh, because they use the word lodestar, it has to have been Mike Pence, but Mike Pence was so transparent. Who's sneaky enough to do that? Well, Kellyanne Conway's kind of sneaky enough to do that. She'd throw him under the bus, and the writing and the analysts say that it was probably somebody who was a woman, but because they used this word, they split that infinitive, blah, 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 blah. You know, this is ridiculous parlor games of who done it. It was probably a group of people who put it together. Hell, for all we know, it was everybody in the room other than the president. For the same people who are defending him on television and denying all the quotes in the Woodward book, they're probably all put it together because they want the world to know. They want to make sure that our allies and adversaries know that
he stands alone on this crap.
Yeah, cuckoo train, rotten Halloween gourd of a president is not going to blow us up.
Now, do you believe, though, that it's an internal letter or an internal memo? I think it came from the outside. I think Putin's got his hand in this one.
Yeah, the Times didn't make that up, of course. I question whether or not they should have done it anonymously. That was a call that was made by opinion staff. I have no idea whether I would have made that same call because I don't know who it was that sent the letter or who was the figure at the head of it. It's definitely came from inside the administration.
You think so? I don't know. I just have this strong suspicion that it came from the outside with the optics of wanting people to believe at the massive level that this was internal just to create more chaos. Right? Well, take the highlight and the focus off other people who are just as guilty of perpetuating other pervasive ills in this world. Let's just throw it all in there.
So you think the Times was duped by this letter, or you think that they're complicit in this?
No, I think this was an outside source, but it's being represented and maybe perhaps believed by the New York Times. And wanting, the Western world to believe that this was, in fact, an inside letter, an inside job, an inside consensus type sentiment. I believe it came from the outside. And, you know, time will tell. And I could be completely off base.
I have a hard time believing that because it would decimate the New York Times and their reputation. You know, the New York Times got dinged a couple times over the years. They had one reporter, I can't remember whose name was, who got caught making up a bunch of sources, and they had to go back and apologize and reinvestigate all his work. I think that whoever gave them the letter, they vetted, I think they checked it out to the best of their ability. And time will tell because it always comes out.
It always does.
Always, other than those 18 and a half minutes that Nixon erased, it always and he still had to resign. But I think it's going to come out. It's all going to come out in the Mueller investigation. And when it does, it's going to blow our socks off. Even though we probably lost the capacity to be surprised, when he comes out with whatever it is he has, Lord almighty, it's got to be good. Because the guy's thorough. He's been digging despite the fact that he's had to suffer the slings and arrows of Trump's insanity and Rudy Giuliani's nightly protests that, you know, we're going to do, you know, launch our own investigation against Mueller and all the stuff. There's going to be something that comes out of this. It's either his taxes or there's going to be a deep, deep Russian connection, whether it's the P tape. It's all going to be in there. I guarantee it.
Right. Yeah. Now, as far as Woodward's book, Fear, is this something that you've already gotten your hands on?
No, I haven't looked at it yet. I'm actually heading back to the States, leaving tomorrow. I want to grab a hard copy and dig into it. But Lord, they've been talking about it so much, I feel like they spoiled the whole thing for me.
Right.
I'm not surprised at anything that I've heard about thus far. Any of the, mm-hmm. the passages that have leaked or the anecdotes from the book, even that Woodward himself has recounted. You know, there have been numerous efforts to try to impugn the reporting and his reputation.
Mm-hmm.
Is the dean of Washington Press Corps. I really, if I have to choose between who am I going to believe, Bob Woodward or Donald Trump, I mean, that's not even worth asking.
There you go. Yeah. I quite like Woodward. I think he's very credible. I think he's very highly esteemed, reputable. He does his homework. So I would be inclined to believe him. But so, you know, in terms of going back to you, and let's talk about your book, you know, when did you first birth this book? Where can people find the book? What's in the makings in terms of a follow-up book, maybe something completely separate?
Well, I first started writing this book in 2014. I had been injured in September 2010, and I had been scheming the book for years afterward, but I hadn't found the quiet and the time that I needed to really dig into it. I had been scribbling notes for years on end, and I had a very detailed idea in mind of just how I would structure the story. The voice I wanted to use, very different from my traditional journalism, which is, like I said, you know, objective, not a lot. There's hardly any of myself in any of my, reporting work. So this was a deep dive into myself, and I chose to write it in a way that was my own authentic voice, warts and all. So there's quite a bit of colorful language in the book. As most reporters are want to use. And I basically shut myself off from the world. I rented this god awful dilapidated house in the mountains east of Pittsburgh. And I sat there for months with, no one but my thoughts and a box full of notes and my notebooks. And I banged out the first draft,
a number
of months. And then I polished it and tinkered with it and shopped it around. It was the shopping around part that took a long time. It took me about 2.5 years to find someone that wanted to publish it.
Mm-hmm.
It was a hard.
That's surprising.
Yeah, it was a hard sell. It really was. When you say I'm writing a first person unvarnished story about getting shot in the face, that's not the typical sanctimonious thousand-yard stare, I'm a tough guy journalist story, but one that really admits to your foibles and fears, that goes against the traditional narrative of books by journalists that typically get. Not saying that they're all like that, but, you know, I chose to write, like I said, a very unvarnished account of what happened, and a lot of it is personal, and it's not a book that's a deep dive into the politics and policy of Afghanistan. There's very little about fighting strategy and whatnot. It's about the personal lives of myself and soldiers and Afghans and those that have been through the same types of struggles that I have and continue to do so, and the kinship that I find among soldiers and Marines and fellow journalists, and how going back into Afghanistan after my injury was was cathartic for me. Not ultimately redemptive, but it helped me get a little bit further down the road. So I finally found a home for it in 2017, and it came out just this past March, and people seemed to like it.
Fantastic. Well, it's interesting to me that for the very standalone reasons as to why your book story would be uniquely different as compared to, as you cited, other forthcoming books from journalists reporting on their experience in the field and whatever that looked like for them in the reporting field. You know, I would think publishers would be like knocking at your door saying, you know, this is fresh. This is unique. This is authentic. This is different. You know, I mean,
publishers don't want unique. They want the same thing that sold before. That's not what publishers want. They want
your story does have the other elements that would be enticing for a publisher. And even if you deviate from the norm in that one regard, I would still think that you would be considered in most respects the package deal for who to partner with.
I hate to contradict you, but I got a stack of rejection letters that would tell you otherwise.
Okay. Well, they're lost, but you know what? There's another example of you staying the course and facing fear in the eye. You know, I'm relentless. I'm going to do this. I know that this is a story that's going to resonate with people. I know that there's people who would lap this up for the bigger message and within the backstory of what transpired for me in the front lines. You know, that's inspiring. I mean, because what that says is, Carmen, you know, if I can be this guy who's out there in the field, this is what I do for a living. Yes, I'm impassioned. Yes, it's what I've signed up for. But, you know, we all know, split second, your life can change in a heartbeat. But not only did you get back on the horse, not only, and we'll talk about how you're, you know, come full circle on the Afghanistan level here in your journey, and motorcycles and all, but, you know, you wrote a book about it too. Like, you bared your soul and you put yourself out there. You know, I love the abdominal spirit. I love people who just are so fiercely committed to, no, there's a reason why this happened. There's a reason why this happened. And rather than focusing on the glum and focusing on the negativity and the pessimism and all the things that could, you know, have totally thrown you under the bus, no, you rose in the ranks and you made something of your life and you made something of that experience and you made all the healing and all the issues you had with relationships going awry because of, you know, how you were dealing and coping at the time. You've made this work for yourself beautifully. And so this is the message that I want to impart to the listening audience. You know, for people who are listening to Carmen, whether you can relate to his vocation, whether you can relate to that unique incident of violence, you know, it doesn't matter. It's a metaphor for everything in life. We're all going to be hit with trials and tribulations. There's always going to be something that knocks us off our feet. You know, call it weaponry, call it circumstances, call it death, call it disappointment, failure, whatever. You know, but it's what you do with it. And so for what you've manifested in your life, for how you've made this work for yourself in a positive, forward-facing direction, I say good on you, Carmen.
Appreciate that. Thanks, Lisa. Has it been easy?
Well, no. And you know what? It never is. And that's why a lot of people succumb to, you know, the false beliefs and the concepts. You know, it's too hard. You know, it should have happened faster. And, you know, people get caught up in this instantaneous, it's got to be a bullseye, it's got to happen overnight. You know, people will tell you, even if they're just talking about success stories, never mind surviving something and then becoming a, you know, a thriver. I say thriver. I don't like the word survivor. But, you know, it's just this fierce discipline, this inner mindset. Like, I am not giving up. I'm not going to let anybody dictate the terms of what I do going forward for the rest of my life. Yeah, I got taken out for a little while. Yeah, I was, you know, bedridden for a bit. Yeah, I've got impaired vision. Yeah, I had to wear a patch and, you know, it sucks. But you know what? It doesn't stop here. There's more to the story and I have to be the one to tell it. And you told it as it all unleashed for you, as it unearthed for you. You rebirth, man. You had a rebirth.
That's true. September 9th was my 8th anniversary of getting shot in the face, and I call that my second birthday because These last 8 years have all been stolen moments. This is bonus time. I survived a trillion one shot. They should have sent me home in a tin cup. There should have been nothing left of me. And, for whatever reason, I managed to make it out, and, I've tried to make the most of what I've had since then.
Well, you certainly have. You have accomplished in that. So you should take great pride in that victory. Well done. Now, do you have a good pirate impersonation?
You know what? My daughter has one of her favorite children's books. Is a book about a gang of pirate children that has these illustrations with little kids wearing eye patches, and every one of them is me. That's you. Yeah. So
right.
You know, she likes to. I have a couple different patches. She likes to try one on, and because she looks a lot like me.
Fantastic.
You know, I have pictures of her wearing her an eye patch as well.
Well, it's also sexy, let me tell you. So you got a few things working in your favor there. So being cognizant of time, Carmen, I mean, these interviews always go far too quickly for my liking. Not to say that you don't have an open standing invitation. You're welcome to come back anytime. What are you very quickly currently working on right now? Where can people find you?
Well, I am currently working on a series now with a colleague of mine who also covers conflict. And surprise, surprise, there's a number of us who do these types of stories who also ride motorcycles. So he and I are working on a story about we had done some work previously about motorcycling in Iraq. And now we are working to turn that story that we produced in print and photo into a series, either for television or a streaming service, about combining good storytelling from the places where we reported previously and motorcycling. So we're going to try to do a series where we're riding in places like Afghanistan, riding in places like Haiti, where I've done a lot of reporting, whether it be on violence or natural disasters there. From places like Mexico, Colombia, here, I actually live in Croatia now, so in the Balkans, and then go back to Iraq. And we're working with a production team to turn it into a series. We'll see how it goes.
Fantastic. Well, you know, only up and up for you, my friend. And I just want to say kudos. You know, I completely commend you on what you've done and what you've manifested for yourself. I mean, you are a walking, talking example of how to do it and how to do it beautifully. So congratulations to you, Carmen. I want to thank you for the gift of your time. And I want to thank the listening audience once again for taking time out of your hectic schedule to join us here on Living Fearlessly with Lisa McDonald. Again, I'd like to thank my corporate sponsors, which is inclusive of Halton Honda, Aha That, and Forever. I also want to remind you that following the live show, you will eventually find the podcast link also uploaded to my host page, Living Fearlessly with Lisa McDonald, on the C-Suite Radio Network. I'm very clear on what my purpose and my passion is. I'm here to uplift you to fear less and to live more. So I want to say have a fantastic, safe weekend. Love and gratitude to you all. Take care and all my best, Carmen. We'll talk soon. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Living Fearlessly with your host, Lisa McDonald.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.